From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Many colleges and universities have expanded their distance learning programs. How do local distance learning institutions stay competitive? We asked the president of University of Maryland University College, fighting to hold on to its claim as America's largest online public university. Then, would a cap on Baltimore's property taxes coax more people to live in the city? Should toll roads be placed in private control? Loyola University Maryland economist Stephen Walters says yes to both and distills his arguments in his new book, Boomtowns, Restoring the Urban American Dream. Plus, since the All-Star break, the Orioles have had the best record in baseball. Tom Hall talks with sports writer Mark Hyman about the secret of their success. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Distance learning is arguably the wave of the future in college education. A growing number of students is choosing courses or entire degree programs that don't require them to show up in class to listen to lectures and take tests, but to learn course material and interact with their professors online. More than a third of all Maryland undergraduates were enrolled in at least one online course, and that was in 2011. As the market shakes out, some Maryland colleges new to offering online courses are learning how to do it. And an institution which for decades dominated distance learning globally, University of Maryland University College, is scrambling to hold on to students who now have many other options for distance learning. This morning we're going to hear from people on both sides of this development. In a few minutes we'll speak with the president of UMUC, Javier Mijares. But first, we wanted to get an introduction to distance learning. So yesterday, we reached out to Dr. Susan Biro, Director of Distance Learning at Carroll Community College and past president of the Maryland Distance Learning Association. Distance learning may be the future. It also has quite a past.
The idea of being able to have people complete education at a physical distance, even with a time lag, has been around for a long time, hundreds of years. Distance education really came about to serve the needs of everyone who did not fit the traditional age student who came to campus and lived on campus. And in the 80s and the 90s, you started to see the web and some of these different technologies really, really, I believe, accelerated not only the type of content, but the delivery and the possibilities.
Dr. Susan Biro, Director of Distance Learning at Carroll Community College, with us now to talk about the expanding possibilities for University of Maryland University College's future is its president, Javier Mijares. Thanks for coming to WIPR.
No, thank you, Sheila, for inviting me.
So the news is that UMUC has announced it's considering ideas to restructure operations. Before we talk about what you may do, why are you making changes?
If you don't mind, let's talk a little bit about our history so we can understand our present. We started in 1947, and from the very beginning, we are about one of the few institutions that from the beginning, our sole mission was to educate working adults. 1947. From the beginning, we never had a physical campus. And we were founded to serve the returning veterans. We grew overseas. We went to serve the military. We were the only institution willing to do that. And we grew and developed online and became the largest online university, as you pointed out. In the 1990s, mid-90s, when we went with online, we were about the only institution doing that. But then in the last 15 years, I was pointed out before, many other institutions went into that space. Some of them, the for-profit institutions. But now we see some of the large public institutions like Penn State, the University of Florida just came out with University of Florida Online, moving into the working adult space. So the competition for us has increased tremendously.
And your enrollment has gone down
and
in the last couple of years.
As a result of that competition, and because we half of our students are military, because of the impact of the federal budget, our enrollments have declined over the last 2 years.
Well, UMUC was early, as you said, going back to 1947, it was early to structure its offerings according to what employers said they needed in workers, particularly the U.S. military. Yeah. It was early to get to use the Internet to offer courses online. And then it seemed to sort of just stop competing effectively. Why was that? That was sort of like, I guess, in the 90s.
I think it's a very natural reaction for many organizations. They are very successful, and they think they will be successful forever doing the same thing. So you sort of rest on your laurels. And when you have, when you are one of the largest player in the online space, there is an assumption, there was an assumption that you would always be, no matter what. So it was complacency, as a matter of fact, that there was a complacency that will always be the largest provider.
And now you're looking at making UMUC a not-for-profit business entity. What does that mean?
Basically, it means the options that we have to go back to growth, and growth is very important to us, volume. In online, volume allows you to provide high quality at low cost. That's the model. High quality, low cost, you need volume. When we start declining, we have to do something about it. We realize that Maryland is small state. Our footprint is Maryland and the military. Maryland is small state. The military is shrinking. So we look into the future, and we realize we have to expand our footprint nationally. It is very difficult to do so as a state agency.
Why?
State agencies, by nature and rightly, are more regulated because they have a lot of taxpayer money, and they are more geared to simply do one very specific thing in the state. In our case, we get very little state support, and being regulated like if we are a state entity actually would impede us in moving into the national market beyond Maryland, and not just the national market, but the international market. Is the flexibilities needed? Something as simple as getting procurement, a marketing contract. It takes us about a year to get a marketing contract. You cannot wait 1 year. And that's just an example of having to be more flexible, more agile than you can actually be by just being a state unit.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Javier Millares, president of the University of Maryland University College. We're talking about restructuring ideas that UMUC is considering. UMUC is also talking about an emphasis on competency-based education, as I understand it, looking at what students can prove they know rather than what classes they've taken. Briefly, how would that work?
This is the exciting part, because now we're talking about really how we serve best our students. Let's assume that you have been working as an accountant, a bookkeeper in an accounting firm. You have learned a lot about the field, but you have not taken courses. So we can ask you, look, if you show us that you really have mastered some basic principles of accounting, why do you have to take a course that is going to teach what you already know? That's one part of competency-based education. Another part of competency-based education is when you have courses that are very clearly defined learning outcomes, if I can give you the resources, the content that you can study in your own, that you can conduct your work, you can do your work, academic work, at your own pace, at your own time, why should I bring you into the strict setting of a course that you have to attend, and perhaps for you it's better to do it in your own with a mentoring from a faculty. So then you can study it at your own pace, at your own time. For some students, that will be shorter. For some students, it may take longer. So basically, competency-based education, at the end of the day, it means what matters is what you have learned, not how or when you learned it.
And are you confident that you can actually test well enough to know what a student knows?
I am confident that we can assess what students know. It is not generally would not be done via tests. It will be done by projects.
Okay.
For instance, you're taking a business class. The project may be build a business plan for a new.
We have just a minute left, and I want to make sure I ask you this idea of restructuring.
Yeah.
Where does it stand? What happens next?
At this point, the idea is out for the UMUC community to provide feedback. This was the recommendation of a group of external business leaders. That recommendation came to me. They appointed them. Now the whole university community is commenting on it. At the end, in the next 2 months, I will have a recommendation to the regents and the chancellor. They will decide if they accept my recommendation. And then if the recommendation is what was recommended by the group, meaning a nonprofit, it will have to go to the General Assembly for action.
And so you would be a not-for-profit.
Basically a not-for-profit with the same mission, public mission we have today.
And still part of the university system.
And it's still linked to the university system. It's a totally different setup. And there is, as of today, I don't know of any university that has that mixed, that is mixed that way.
I appreciate you explaining it to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure to be here.
Javier Meares is president of University of Maryland University College. We've got more information about UMUC on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, figuring out what would make Baltimore City boom. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Stephen J.K. Walters, an economist who's made a name for himself advising Major League Baseball clubs and advocating property tax revolts, truly loves cities. He believes cities are concentrations of human, social, and physical capital that can transform lives and make their residents successful. Walters believes no city is beyond hope, and any city can be a boomtown if it just follows the prescriptions he's distilled in years as a professor of economics at Loyola University, Maryland, and at the Johns Hopkins Institute for Applied Economics, Global Health, and the Study of Business Enterprise. So he called his new book, Boomtowns, Restoring the Urban American Dream, and he's here with me to tell us about it. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Sheila. Thanks.
You devote about the first third of this book to a theory you've spoken and written about a lot in Baltimore. Cut property taxes, put a lid on them that city officials can't raise without a vote of the people, and watch the investors and citizens pour back into the city and make it healthy again. Briefly, why do you think it would work that way?
Well, because it's worked that way wherever it's been tried. Sometimes it's been tried against the will of the political hierarchy within those cities. But it's worked in Boston. It's worked in San Francisco and Oakland and other cities where caps have been put on. So the key thing that you pointed out, that was a great summary of that proposal, is put a lid on. So there's a cash flow issue about taxes. Everybody's familiar with that. We don't like to pay them. It makes us a little poorer when we have to dig deeper in our pockets and so forth. But the other thing, the putting a lid on, is really related to what I think is one of the main themes of this book, which is you've got to protect people's property rights if they're going to want to live in your domain. And so by capping the taxes in some way and making it really hard for people to just sort of make a grab for the value of your property, you reassure people about investing in a city. And, you know, the investments that we're talking about in cities last decades. I mean, one of the great things about Baltimore is some of the investments that people made over a century ago are still mm-hmm. here. So if you're going to invest in something that's going to last 50 or 100 years, you're going to pay very close attention to, well, what can happen over the long haul. So the lid is kind of a key thing here. So the cities that have succeeded in this domain are the ones that have said, okay, not only are we going to make taxes more competitive, but we're going to put a binding promise on ourselves not to go after you and reduce the value of your property with tax hikes that can happen anytime it's politically convenient. So that happened in Massachusetts with Prop 2.5. It happened in California with Prop 13. What's hard to do is to get cities to vote these caps on themselves voluntarily.
Well, yeah, and it's hard to get from here to there. I mean, you lay out
right.
that San Francisco was able to do it without a lot of cuts in
right.
services because it got tens of millions of dollars from the state because the state had
right.
surpluses.
They got $100 million in year one of their budget problems. They got $1 million from the state in year two. They made it on their own in year three. And by year four, they actually were starting to run surpluses again. So okay. it was essentially one electoral cycle where San Francisco had budget problems where they needed some relief.
And that's a year of a bunch of people's lives.
That's – well, and politically, it's poisonous because if you're the mayor of a city and you have a four-year term and I tell you you're going to have 4 years of budget problems, you're going to say, well, then I'm not listening to your advice about what to do with tax rates and so forth.
You write that other factors might have hollowed out Rust Belt cities like Baltimore, maybe
mm-hmm.
white flight, manufacturing
mm-hmm.
moving south, the appeal of suburban space. But you think property taxes can overcome all of that?
I think property taxes can reverse the outward momentum. And the property rights, the reassurance that a tax cap will give you, that not only will tax rates be competitive, but they won't. Those competitive rates won't go away as the political winds shift. I think everything we've seen has been that when that kind of assurance has been made, out-migration ceases of people, but also out-migration of capital investment, and in-migration starts. Nothing else has to change so dramatically as that basic property rights issue. So I really think that's a feel-good story because I think what we've seen is No great political cultural change has to happen. We don't have to magically transform the schools into something new and different. We don't have to magically change crime rates for this to happen. What we've seen is that when investors get reassured about the security of their property rights, they come back. And then once they come back, you can start working on these other problems because the city's better capitalized, better financed. The city government has more resources with which to fight other problems. But you have to fundamentally reassure people about their property rights. And if you do that, great things happen.
As economist Stephen J.K. Walters here on WIPR Maryland Morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book, just published, Boomtowns, Restoring the Urban American Dream. I don't want listeners to think the book is all about taxes. You also take on unions and praise right-to-work laws.
Mm-hmm.
Right-to-work laws say that workers in a shop that's been organized by a union don't have to pay union dues.
Right.
And you call right-to-work, quote, simply the most obvious and effective step, close quote, to a better business climate.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
It's a very visible signal that a large number of regulatory policies and so forth will be more conducive to capital formation and less repulsive to capital flight or repulsive to capital investment, I should say. It's the studies that have been done about right-to-work laws make clear that it's not a panacea by itself. But usually the states that pass a right-to-work law are also passing other regulatory reforms and tax reforms that make capital investment more secure and improve the cash flow from capital investment. So it's if you pass a right-to-work law, nothing's going to happen overnight without going along with some other policies that are more conducive, make the investment climate more friendly and the labor climate more competitive.
You are a big fan of putting public assets like toll roads under private control.
Mm-hmm.
When does that make sense?
Well, what we're seeing with infrastructure is that there's a terrible short-sightedness problem under public ownership. When assets are owned publicly, the officials that we trust to administer those assets face election cycles, and so they tend to focus on the short run. They tend to focus on what needs to be done right now to reelect them to guarantee their political future. Often that involves robbing from the future to pay the present. Sometimes it means raiding the capital budget, the capital maintenance budgets for roads and bridges and so forth to raise pensions for public employee unions, say. So by taking things out of the public domain, by privatizing ownership of certain key infrastructure assets, you can cultivate a longer time frame for analysis for when you have to restore things, when you have to rehabilitate things. The private owners of assets tend to take a longer view than people who have to face an election every 2 or 4 years, and so they tend not to raid those capital maintenance budgets quite as eagerly as the political sphere does. So anytime you're talking about key infrastructure that is susceptible to this kind of short-sightedness problem, you should start thinking about taking those keys away from the public sector and putting them in the hands of somebody who will say, well, I need to maximize the value of these assets over the long haul. And that's generally what happens in the private sector. Nothing's perfect. Private sector has people that behave in a short-sighted fashion too. But the betting odds favor private ownership over public ownership when you're talking about this kind of long-lived asset that you have to keep and maintain and constantly rehabilitate.
And I'm sure there are people who would argue that point too, but we're out of time.
Right.
I appreciate you talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen J.K. Walters, professor of economics at Loyola University, Maryland, just published Boomtowns, Restoring the Urban American Dream. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and more of this interview, including the TRIM property tax cap in Prince George's County and whether it fits into Walters' theory. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Mark Hyman, sports. Stick with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
And good morning, everybody, on this beautiful Friday morning. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1, and we're going to talk sports this morning with our sports guru, Mark Hyman. He's a former contributing editor at Business Week magazine and a former columnist for the Sports Business Journal. He's written for the New York Times, and he's currently on the faculty of George Washington University. He's also the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. He joins us this morning on the line from New Jersey, where he's visiting his mom. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. So the Major League Baseball owners have been meeting this week at the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Baltimore by the harbor. And one of their big orders of business was to elect a new commissioner. They have done so. They did this yesterday. After a few votes, they decided on Rob Manfred. He's the current chief operating officer. He'll succeed Bud Selig, who is retiring in January at the age of 80. He was the odds-on favorite going in. It took a few votes. It looks like the owners vote for a new commissioner the way Cardinals vote for a pope. They wait until they finally get a majority. Do you read anything into the fact that it took them a few tries to come to consensus about Mr. Manfred?
Well, I mean, you're right about it being a Byzantine process. You put 30 high-powered, ultra-rich sports team owners in a room, and you're going to have dissent. I mean, that's just a given. In this case, Rob Manfred really was the choice that Bud Selig, the outgoing commissioner, had given his endorsement to and really wanted to get the job. And there was a small group of owners led by Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the Chicago White Sox, who were pushing another candidate, Tom Werner, one of the owners of the Boston Red Sox. So, Werner got one more vote than he got enough votes to prevent Manfred from getting the nod on the first ballot. But, eventually Manfred got the majority that he needed. So, I think it's basically an endorsement of Bud Selig's term as commissioner, and I think we're basically going to see Rob Manfred steering the same course.
Briefly, what's Bud Selig's legacy for Major League Baseball going to be?
Well, I think it's mixed. Early in his term, he had a real rocky time. Bud Selig presided over the 1994 lockout that canceled the World Series, the only time that's happened, and had a very difficult time with labor relations early in his term. And there's also the steroids crisis that really baseball was very slow to react to. Those are the negatives. I think on the positive side, revenues in baseball have just skyrocketed in the last 10 years. The rise of digital revenue, meaning, the MLB Network, MLB.com, all of those things have had an amazingly positive effect on baseball, and I think Bud Selig has to get credit for that. And one other thing that I'd mention is that we've got some pretty good competitive balance in baseball now, which we didn't have when Bud Selig assumed the job in 1992. I mean, just look at the American League right now. The teams leading the divisions in the American League are the Oakland A's, the Kansas City Royals, and the Baltimore Orioles, three small to middle market teams, and that would not have happened in 1992.
Yeah, there's no longer these high payroll dynasties like the Yankees, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and I think Bud Selig gets credit for that.
And Manfred was at Selig's side the whole time, or for much of the time that this was all happening. So, as you say, we can probably expect more of the same, or at least more of the same kind of vision and priorities.
Yeah, I mean, Manfred's strengths, the issues he knows best are labor relations and the whole testing regimen for drugs. Those are the issues he was most involved in. And I think, in both cases, he had a very positive role. So if those are the issues you care about most in baseball, baseball hasn't had a work stoppage since 1994. And football, hockey, and basketball have all had work stoppages since then. So baseball now is in a pretty good place with its labor relations.
Well, speaking of teams that are in first place.
Something magic happens every time you go. You make the magic happen. The magic of Orioles baseball when the game is close.
The Baltimore Orioles are 7.5 games in front of the Toronto Blue Jays for first place. They are 14.5 games ahead of last place Boston Red Sox. And I say that simply because it's fun to say that. the Orioles are just on a tear. Mark, what sticks out to you about the stats that have happened, say, like in the second half of the season, like from the All-Star break to now?
Well, first of all, Tom, I told you we should have bought season tickets. I mean,
you did.
I begged you to go in with me on a plan, and you stiffed me, and now look at us. Now we're not going to go to the World Series, so thanks a lot for that.
Mea culpa maxima. Yep, you got it.
Well, you know, since the All-Star break, the Orioles have really been on fire. Since June 30, they have the best record in baseball, 27-11. They've won 8 straight series for the first time since 1993. They're leading the major leagues in home runs with 152. And the pitching, which, you know, has been a real question mark, I think, throughout the season, has been fantastic since the beginning of July. The collective ERA of the staff is under 3. So, I mean, they're really hitting on all cylinders now, and, I mean, that's reflected in the lead. I think they have the largest lead now of any team in any division in baseball. So, you know, start looking on the internet for World Series tickets.
Yeah, I mean, playoff tickets, I mean, that's a real discussion that can start happening really fairly soon. I mean, they're inching along, getting mathematically guaranteed, you know, towards being guaranteed a spot in the playoffs. Hasn't happened yet. And they've done it, you know, with some pretty serious injuries. Manny Machado is out again for the second time. Matt Wieters has not played for most of the season. Speaking of injuries, let's talk about a former Oriole who had a short stint with the New York Yankees. Brian Roberts is apparently retiring from baseball. He's 36 years old.
Yeah, I was sad to see that. The Yankees, remember, the Orioles chose not to re-sign Brian Roberts this season, and he did sign a one-year contract with the Yankees. And I guess about 10 days ago, the Orioles released him after they traded for Steven Drew, who had been who is and had been playing shortstop for the Red Sox, and the Yankees turned him into a second baseman. And Brian Roberts was hitting .237. I think another reason for his release was that he was two at bats shy of reaching a bonus payment with the Yankees. So the timing may have been related to that. But yes, you know, I'm feeling a little nostalgic because Brian Roberts was one of the Orioles' best players. You know, at a time when the Orioles weren't that good, but he was an all-star, two-time all-star player. In 2009, he led the American League in doubles with 56. But then his career took an unfortunate turn in a couple of ways. First, he was kind of caught up in the steroid scandal. He was named in the Mitchell Report and later acknowledged that he had taken steroids briefly, one or two times in 2003. And then, even more significantly, he suffered two concussions within 7 months of each other in 2010 and 2011, and he really was never the same player after that.
Well, we wish him all the best, but you're right. He really is a standout at a time when the Orioles were not by any means in contention, and there's something, you know, particularly touching about that, that even when the team itself isn't doing particularly well, Brian Roberts was always a standout star. Let's talk about another issue swirling around the Orioles, and that's this dispute about Masson, the television network that broadcasts not only the Orioles games, but the games of the Washington Nationals, I guess is the Mid-Atlantic Sports Network. There's a strange arrangement with this thing in terms of who owns it and how much each party owns it. And Peter Angelos, the owner of the Orioles, has been in court with the league and the Nationals to try to hold off rejiggering the arrangement that they had. Give us some context of this. What was the arrangement that was in place in 2005 when the Montreal Expos moved down to Washington and became the Washington Nationals?
Tom, I think there are two important things to understand. The first is that the Orioles and the Nationals own this network. And that's a little bit different than the traditional arrangement where a team like the Orioles would sell the rights to broadcast its games to some television network. And then the team would receive that rights fee, and the network would, or the television network would have the right to sell advertising. In this model, the Orioles own the network. They're not selling the rights. They're retaining the rights, and they're benefiting from selling all of the advertising. And it's a much more lucrative model for teams. That's number one. The second point is that Peter Angelos was very opposed to the Washington, to a Washington franchise for a long time. So when Major League Baseball made the decision to move the Montreal Expos to Washington, they got a lot of resistance from Peter Angelos, and rightly so, because the Orioles territory included Washington. So as part of the agreement that resulted in Peter Angelos permitting this to go forward, he and the Orioles got a majority interest in this network called MASN, which also broadcasts Nationals games. And the agreement called for the Nationals' interest in that network to increase over time. And that's really what the fight is about right now, whether the agreement is equitable, whether the Nationals deserve a bigger slice of that pie. And Major League Baseball has been trying to mediate this dispute for several years, really, and has not gotten very far. And now it looks like it might actually result in litigation.
So the Nationals basically want to sort of change the agreement from how it was originally structured almost 10 years ago. They want a bigger chunk of the pie than they're getting, because I think everybody's finally woken up to the fact that, boy, this is a pretty lucrative way to do things.
Well, that's part of it, and it's also another factor is that the value of these television deals has increased dramatically from the time that this initial deal was negotiated. And the Nationals want a new deal, a revised deal that reflects that. And Peter Angelos' position is, hey, we negotiated a deal years ago, and we ought to be sticking to the terms of that deal. And, you know, Bud Selig, this is one of the kind of loose ends that he may be leaving behind. He has been trying for months and months to try to get these two sides to agree on a new formula, and he hasn't gotten very far.
Speaking of litigation, I want to talk about the O'Bannon case and the NCAA. Ed O'Bannon was a standout basketball player for UCLA. He's the lead plaintiff in a very interesting and very, I think it's not too strong a word to call it, revolutionary decision that was handed down just this week. What happens in this ruling in which the NCAA got something in between a slap on the wrist and a bat to the knees?
Yeah, very interesting and I think important case that is really going to change college sports fundamentally, I think, eventually, although the decision probably won't have much impact in the short term. But Ed O'Bannon's suit was about whether the NCAA needed to share some of the revenue that it was collecting for using the names and likenesses of college athletes. Ed O'Bannon's likeness was used in a video game, and he made the assertion that, hey, if you're using my likeness, I should benefit from this in some way financially. So what this decision really does for the first time is clears the way for players on the college level to collect a small amount of money for the revenue that's generated by these sources. The court decision says that they can collect up to $5,000 a year that is put in escrow and that the players can collect after they graduate.
And, of course, what it does is it shoots a big hole in the argument that amateurism is at the basis of the NCAA's activity. And I'm afraid, Mark, we're going to have to leave it there. We will pick up again on this, because this is not by any means the last we've heard of this issue with the NCAA. So appreciate your time this morning, as always, and safe trip home. Appreciate it.
Great talking to you, Tom.
Mark Hyman is on the sports management faculty at George Washington University. His latest book is called Concussions and Our Kids. We've got a link to more information on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR in Baltimore. The program is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We've had production help this summer from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer. Today is their last day with us here at Maryland Morning, and we wish them all the best with thanks for all their help. Zeke's Coffee in Laurelville also helps us out. You can find them on the web at zekescoffee.com. You can find us on the web, too. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning to leave a comment about something you've heard or make a suggestion about an interview you'd like to hear on the show. For Sheila and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.